From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Daisy Rosario in for Maria Hinojosa. Today, what does it mean to be a genius? We'll introduce you to the brilliantly successful people that you've never heard of.
There are, I think, large chunks of the country where people would say both Romeo who and Bachata what.
And we'll meet a teacher taking kids in California to the next level.
When I first started teaching physics at Citrus Hill, there were 41 students in the class enrolled. And today, 8 years later, we have over 350 students enrolled.
Plus, Latino studies. What is it and where is it going? All this and more coming up on Latino USA as we look at what genius is. I'm Daisy Rosario in for Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Daisy Rosario in for Maria Hinojosa. They say genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. And while that little nugget of wisdom can be true in practice, we also often talk about genius in terms of the IQ. It stands for intelligence quotient. Now, if you Google Latinos and IQ, you will see a number of articles from 2013 relating to a conservative immigration activist, Jason Richwine, then with the Heritage Foundation. Last year, it was reported that in 2009, Richwine wrote a doctoral dissertation in which he claimed that Hispanics have consistently lower IQs than whites. And while he does, to a degree, acknowledge some socioeconomic factors, he also believes these low IQs to be strongly related to genetics. Here he is talking at an event organized by the American Enterprise Institute in 2008.
There are real differences between groups, not just trivial ones that we happen to notice more than we should. Races differ in all sorts of ways, and probably the most important way is in IQ. Decades of psychometric testing has indicated that in, at least in America, you have Jews with the highest average IQ, usually followed by East Asians, and then you have non-Jewish whites, Hispanics, and then blacks. These are real differences. They're not going to go away tomorrow, and for that reason, we have to address them in our immigration discussions and our debate. And you can see that when you combine these two things, group differences in ability combined with a natural tribal disposition is going to create usually parallel cultures within a multiracial society rather than an assimilated culture. And I think that is a major, major obstacle to the assimilation of today's immigrants because they are not from Europe, which is, I think, a major difference.
The text of Richwine's dissertation also includes the line, "From the perspective of Americans alive today, the low average IQ of Hispanics is effectively permanent." Now, while IQ does tell you a few things, it's important to remember that
our brain is an incredibly complex machine.
This is Dr. Michael Lopez of ABD Associates, a group that creates reports that help shape public policy. He specializes in childhood development, particularly in low-income as well as culturally and linguistically diverse communities. He told me a little bit about cognitive abilities.
Fluid intelligence or broad ability to reason.
To form concepts and solve problems.
Crystallized intelligence, which is
really the kind of overall depth and breadth of knowledge base.
You know, like how much knowledge you have.
Quantitative reasoning skills.
The ability to kind of manipulate quantitative concepts and relationships.
General reading and writing ability.
Memory, there's different aspects of short-term memory or long-term memory, working memory.
Because they're not all one and the same.
Visual processing, being able to
perceive things. To see something and then be able to analyze it, synthesize it, and think about patterns and shapes.
Auditory processing.
Think about when you hear something and that going to your brain and then you making sense of it with all the knowledge that you have and then being able to generate speech to say something about it, like we're doing right now.
So there's lots of different ways in which all the different information gets processed. And so all that together, the ability and all those different pieces collectively being what we often think of as the overall cognitive abilities.
But even if you test all of these, Lopez says it doesn't tell the whole story, and he worries that believing that things like intelligence are innate and fixed can have real-world effects on what people do and don't do.
You have different potential courses of action that if you view my poor, I'm just picking on myself. If you view my poor achievement as a result of because I'm Latino, there's not a whole lot you're going to do policy-wise. You can't change me to be a non-Latino through a policy initiative.
But if you acknowledge other important factors, it can create the potential for action.
I think that there are probably three buckets of issues that I think are really critical when you talk about and the achievement gap that people often talk about, and especially when you look at low-income and or diverse populations. So those three are poverty, measurement, and educational disparities.
Let's start with poverty.
Poverty tends to have a detrimental effect on many outcomes, including educational outcomes, regardless of your race or ethnicity or whatever. So basically, poverty is still a huge risk factor for anyone.
Then there's measurement. He's talking about what we think of as testing.
For many of the measures used to assess children's academic performance have not really been adequately developed or critically examined to be psychometrically sound for use with culturally and linguistically diverse populations.
For example,
if the questions include words or concepts that are systematically going to be less familiar or understandable to different diverse subgroups, then you're already introducing a systematic bias to how that measure is going to perform.
Lopez says idioms are a good example of this. You could take a test in another language that has been translated directly from English and try understanding a sentence such as "you spilled the beans" without the cultural contextual understanding that it means you failed at keeping a secret. To a native Spanish speaker, it just sounds like you're being careless with food.
So then the third area is really the educational disparities. And so we come back to, in some ways, to the poverty issues.
Things like access and availability to good schools and other educational resources.
I think the evidence is pretty clear that there's a large body of research that shows that high quality early educational programs can produce substantial and lasting gains in children's educational and other outcomes, including for Latino children.
Which is a good example of how the way we look at the idea of intelligence and ability has real-world effects. Right now, early childhood education is a substantial part of education policy. For Lopez, the research reflects something he grew up knowing.
Think of my father's situation. He was born and raised in East L.A., and not only in East L.A. in poverty, but he was living in a trailer, and yet he, through hard work of his own, I'll give him that credit, but also through some important supports that were provided to him, like some of the things that I'm talking about. Some opportunities that he was provided that he then took advantage of and leveraged and worked hard for, to where he ended up at the pinnacle of his career working in the White House.
And Lopez sees the connection between that and his own success.
I'm very thankful for that because I grew up in a middle-class background because of all his hard work and all his efforts and all the programs. Even back then, what few there were, the opportunities that were provided to him, the supports that were provided to him. And so to me, that is a testament to what we can do, what's possible to do, and what we ought to be doing.
As we go on, let's keep in mind what Dr. Lopez was saying. Now, gifted high school students often end up taking advanced placement, or AP, classes. But what about the low-income school districts where AP science courses aren't offered? Teacher Michael Towns started the first physics and engineering program at a high school in Southern California. Most of his students are Latino and low-income. In 2012, a quarter of the Mexican-American kids that passed the AP electricity and magnetism test in the entire state of California came from Mr. Towns' class. Mr. Towns and Alejandro Torres, one of his students, tell us how they're doing it.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is a follow-up to a previous lecture, and it's going to be...
When I answer the phone in my classroom, I almost always answer it. Michael Towne, welcome to the front lines of education. How can I help you?
What did you say, Leslie?
Small amplitude oscillation.
Yes, small amplitude oscillation.
When I first started teaching physics at Citrus Hill, there were 41 students in the class enrolled. And today, 8 years later, we have over 350 students enrolled. And somehow our class produced about a quarter of all the Mexican Americans passing the exam in the state.
Efren, give us one thing, please.
The greater displacement.
The incredible part of that statistic is what it really says is there's not nearly enough programs in the state that are providing the kind of support that students like mine need to be able to pass that exam. So what do? I go out there and recruit heavily. Any student who wants to take the exam, and I carefully try to explain to them the rigor that's going to be involved and the demand on their time, will be accepted into the class. one of the main perks that we offer is that if you pass the AP Physics class at our school, then you'll be well prepared to go into college.
Say that again?
The greater the displacement from equilibrium, the stronger the restoring force the spring will produce.
In your groups right now, try to reword what he just said. Say what he said, but try to say it in a different way.
The longer your distance, your longer.
Many students are intimidated by speaking about physics in technical terms, what I call the professor's voice of physics. And so I offer them and train them to use what I call the 10-year-old voice. How would a 10-year-old explain this? What would it sound like to your really curious cousin who happens to be 10? I then train them to transfer that knowledge into what we call the developing high school voice. That is, how do you use the trigonometry and rudimentary calculus that you know to start describing the concepts of physics and then scaffold them into the more complex language of what we call official physics or the language of a professor.
Hello, my name is Alejandro Torres. I am currently a business analyst. I graduated with a dual major in physics and applied mathematics from the University of California, Riverside. I was actually part of his first class. We didn't have the great numbers he has now in passing the exam. A couple of people passed it, if I'm not mistaken. To that day, that was a big success.
My former students who have gone on to take physics courses in college and even gotten physics degrees themselves come back and give back to the community. They get paid a very nominal fee, and yet they provide hundreds of hours of tutoring over the course of the year.
It really much helped because all those people that I tutored and my same classmates from my year, now they're graduating in engineering degrees, and their people are majoring in more in math and science, and it's just great to see that all that has turned out from just because initially from what came to be his first AP class.
In the next 20 years, we're going to need an enormous number of students to do high-paid, highly technical jobs that require education in the sciences. And I'm here to tell you, if you don't live in the Southwest the way I do, the future of America is Latino students. We're going to have to start investing in them right now.
I unfortunately did not pass the exam. I did get a 2, but that to me just showed me that you accomplished something. You must have learned something. I mean, I'm succeeding right now in my eyes and in other people's eyes. And if it wasn't for him, I don't know. Maybe I would have done something else.
There's more than one way to define genius. Is a student who fights his way into a class that he or she was not scheduled to be in through the tenacity and their unwillingness to give up on himself, is that student any less a genius than a person who got into the class easily because he or she had high test scores? I believe that when students see that they are capable of doing problems in physics or succeeding in a class that most adults would consider to be unthinkable, then they look at themselves in a whole different light. Once they see that they have that internalized genius, nothing can stop them. And so I think that physics is a way to empower students to see their strengths and to get them to start making decisions based on those strengths instead of based on their fears or based on stereotypes that other people hold for them.
Michael Town is a physics teacher at Citrus Hill High in Riverside, California. He's a winner of the Fishman Prize, awarded for outstanding teaching in low-income communities. Coming up on Latino USA, when genius and deal-making just isn't enough.
I failed to get the Democratic caucus when we were in the majority to give us a vote on immigration reform. I was hopeful that he would be able to achieve what I didn't.
Stay with us.
Una familia, muchos rincones. La habitación con 9 sillones, tantas polillas, tantos colchones, están todos rotos los corazones. Una familia y muchas caras, fotos de todos, fotos de aviones, tantas ventanas y postigones, están todos muertos, están en cajones.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Daisy Rosario in for Maria Hinojosa. You'd have to be a genius to get a bill through Congress these days, with the political chops of Lyndon B. Johnson and Tip O'Neill. So meet South Florida Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart. He had a new strategy up his sleeve when he decided to convince his fellow House Republicans to support comprehensive immigration reform. Diaz-Balart worked at it for a year and failed. Reporter Matt Laszlo caught up with the congressman at a diner to ask what went wrong.
When you enter Pete's Diner early in the morning, the smell of grease wakes your nostrils right up. At the diner, a few federal lawmakers and national reporters are seen deep in hushed conversations. Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart comes here every once in a while to order a thick, salty omelet and a tall glass of orange juice.
Everything's fine?
Thank you.
Diaz-Balart's schedule hasn't really let up since immigration reform was derailed a few weeks ago. While he's now focused on convincing skeptical Republicans to send the president more than $1 billion to help deal with unaccompanied minors, previously Diaz-Balart was trying to convince many of those same skeptics to allow millions of undocumented workers to become citizens. He says many didn't want to reward illegal activity with citizenship.
You know, that was a legitimate issue. We can deal with that.
Mario Diaz-Balart says many in the GOP have been painted with an unfair brush. While Democrats call them heartless, he says his fellow Republicans feel it's unfair to force many immigrants to the end of the line, while those who crossed illegally hop to the front. But Diaz-Balart found a simple solution that gained GOP support. Apply the current pass to citizenship to all those already in the country. In essence, putting the newcomers at the back of the line instead of the front.
In other words, you know, there are a bunch of current pathways. You know, if you marry an American citizen, that they claim you, right? So there's a number of pathways. They're not perfect, they're not ideal, but that's what they have.
His plan was also to tweak and massage some of those current pathways, hopefully making it easier to become a citizen for those who have been working and raising their families here for decades. As for the rest of the details Diaz-Balart ironed out on immigration, he's close-lipped.
This is about the only detail I'll give you.
Through talking one by one with many Republicans, Mario Diaz-Balart is confident he solidified the votes to pass immigration reform for the first time since Ronald Reagan was president. But the effort blew up, and now immigration activists, lawmakers, and President Obama have thrown in their respective towels. Diaz-Balart says the effort failed because of the defeat of House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. Diaz-Balart says Republicans fled the cause because they feared voters perceived Cantor's loss was due to immigration, even though they know Cantor lost because he was perceived as a Washington insider back home. He says the perception to voters is what mattered.
They believe it's immigration, and they're going to say, oh, so you still ran the...
One of Diaz-Balart's partners in the reform effort at the Capitol was Congressman Luis Gutierrez, an Illinois Democrat. He's been a leading voice calling for an immigration overhaul. He says Diaz-Balart had a difficult job.
I was hopeful that he would be able to achieve where I failed. I failed to get the Democratic caucus when we were in the majority to give us a vote on immigration reform. I failed in 2007, 8, 9, 10. I was hopeful that he would be able to achieve what I didn't.
Gutierrez says Diaz-Balart succeeded while House Speaker John Boehner failed.
And because of his work, if Boehner would give us a vote, we'd pass a bill reforming our immigration system. We'd pass one. And unfortunately, he's not going to get a vote. So it's that leadership question.
But South Florida Democratic Congressman Joe Garcia says if Diaz-Balart truly cared about the issue, he'd join Democrats in signing a petition that would force a House vote on the issue.
He and the 30 others that are for it should sign a discharge petition and get this done.
Back at the diner, Diaz-Balart brushes that aside. He maintains he walked a tightrope in crafting a proposal that could win over both Democrats and the most important votes, conservatives.
I can't go farther to the right.
Mario Diaz-Balart isn't giving up hope. He says there's still a window for reform to pass after the November elections. But he fears Democrats will walk away because they want a campaign issue in 2016 as opposed to a policy issue this year. For Latino USA, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Now we're going to talk about the secret genius. We're not talking about a Goodwill Hunting type janitor who's secretly a math wizard, but rather hyper-successful Latinos who are making it big here in the U.S., but you still may have never heard of them. Producer Antonia Cerejido has the story.
The other night, I had dinner with my cousin and some of her friends, and someone brought a Dr. Pepper bottle. I noticed there was a picture of Romeo Santos on it, and I said, whoa, Romeo is really blowing up. Everyone looked back at me with blank stares.
There are, I think, large chunks of the country where people would say both Romeo who and bachata what?
My cousin and her friends clearly fall into this category. What they should have known is that Romeo Santos is a super popular singer from the Bronx and is known as the king of bachata.
This is Larry Roeder. I'm a culture reporter for the New York Times.
Larry recently published an article about Romeo.
It's a real feat to sell out Yankee Stadium two nights in a row. The first night when I went there, he said, if Paul McCartney can sell out Yankee Stadium two nights in a row, so can we Latinos. And then 50,000 people are, you know, cheering and applauding.
To be clear, Romeo is the only individual other than Paul McCartney to sell out Yankee Stadium. The video for his biggest hit, Propuesta Indecente, has nearly twice as many views as Beyoncé's Drunken Love on YouTube. So, okay. If this guy is so popular, why isn't he like other Latino stars like Shakira or Ricky Martin, who are known by pretty much everyone?
If you think of Ricky Martin or Marc Anthony or Enrique Iglesias, all of them at one time or another have done records in English. But Romeo's philosophy, I think, is a little bit different. I remember when I interviewed him before the first solo album, he said, you know, crossover can be in two directions. Why should I have to go, you know, exclusively to that side? Why can't those folks come to my side?
And those folks have gone to his side. Romeo has done collaborations with stars as big as Usher and Nicki Minaj. Drake even sings in Spanish for Romeo's track Odio. So I knew who Romeo was, as all Latin music lovers should. But as a casual soccer fan, I was unaware of Javier Hernandez, better known as Chicharito, is a Mexican soccer player who plays for the English club team Manchester United.
He's built a reputation as a goal poacher.
With his quick step and flashy goals, Chicharito has become something of a fan favorite. Manchester United is currently touring the U.S. Brent Maximin, a soccer reporter, has been following Chicharito and Manchester United's experience here in the States.
I was genuinely surprised by how popular he was even back in 2011. I went to a match between Manchester United and Barcelona. So you had, you know, most of the jerseys, fan jerseys that you would see would be Wayne Rooney and Lionel Messi, which is to be expected. But right up there with them was Chicharito.
Chicharito, which means little green pea in Spanish, is a hero because he's one of the few Mexican players to have found success outside of Mexico.
His story is very fairy tale-like.
Eugenio Fernandez is a soccer fan from Monterrey, Mexico, who lives in New York.
It was a very quick move to Manchester, and he did really, really well. And so I think fans look up to him because of that.
Not to mention, Chicharito has caught the attention of the ladies.
Well, he's my wife's favorite player.
Yeah?
Yeah, we were taking pictures at the game, and I'm looking at her pictures afterwards, and they're about 75% Chicharito.
Women may love Chicharito, but teen girls love Bethany Mota.
That's me. I'm confident. Hi, guys. Today I'm wearing a ponytail, and it feels a little weird because I never wear ponytails, but whatever. We're just going to go with it. So recently,
Bethany Mota is a YouTube phenomenon. She makes do-it-yourself videos aimed at teens. Her YouTube handle, MacBarbie07, has almost 7 million subscribers, and the website Social Blade estimates that her yearly earnings from just the videos, not sponsorships, not anything else, could be up to $1.4 million.
MacBarbie has this audience of young women who are interested in makeup and DIY-type projects for young women.
This is Sara Inés Calderón, a digital media expert who has worked at Me Too, a Latino-focused YouTube network.
So she's a very attractive candidate for makeup companies and cosmetic companies and craft companies.
With all the attention Bethany got for her videos, she attracted sponsors and even has her own clothing and decor line at Aeropostal. A Latina teen from Southern California, she started making videos at age 13 after being bullied.
What ends up happening is people don't see themselves reflected in the media, and so they say, hey, well, I'm going to make my own videos. And I think that that's one reason why Latinos have been really attracted to YouTube, both as consumers and as producers, is because they're not getting what they're not getting their fix or whatever from TV or from movies.
Bethany is relatable and goofy. She laughs at herself. It's not hard to figure out why she's popular with young girls and teens.
My eyebrows look extremely uneven in this video. Let's not talk about it. Hey guys, what are you doing in my room? Get out. I'm home.
I think a big chunk of the fact that these women on YouTube in particular are hidden or unknown to most people is the fact that YouTube is a very, very young platform. And so teenagers aren't necessarily the ones who are setting the trends for in the media landscape. They do, obviously, to a certain degree, but it's going to take the adults who have the decision-making power over what's going to be popular in terms of the media, in terms of brands and whatnot, to catch on to what the young people are doing, and that takes a little bit of time.
That time might be soon. A new survey commissioned by Variety found that the top five influential celebrities, according to teens, are all YouTube stars. So if you haven't heard of these guys, well, now you have. I guess they're not that secret anymore. Bachata, soccer, and YouTube's rising popularity is a sign of how things are changing and could be an indicator of how young Latinos are leaving their mark on popular culture. For Latino USA, I'm Antonia Cerejido.
Te fallaron las flechas y de tantas violetas que por ti he regalado en mi jardín no hay ni una flor. Pues dile al amor que no toque mi puerta, que yo no estoy en casa, que no vuelva mañana. A mi corazón ya le ha fallado en ocasiones.
If you've been keeping up with all things tech over the past year, you know that there's another, smaller video sharing platform, Vine, offering the tech-savvy a new way to reach some level of internet fame and create a whole new brand of genius. Vine is simple. 6-second videos, usually edited, that play on a loop and appear in a timeline the way tweets appear on Twitter or pictures appear on Instagram. The videos themselves range from the mundane to the wildly creative. Some of the most popular Vines are babies falling asleep while eating or guys singing along to sappy pop songs in the car. But the real stars of Vine are the comedians, who have managed to make full jokes fit into those measly 6 seconds. Vine was released in early 2013, and within a few months, it was the number one app in Apple's store. Here's Latino USA's Michael Simon Johnson with more.
David Lopez is a professional Viner.
Oh, nice man first.
It's a satchel.
Yeah, whatever.
It's a satchel!
He has 3.2 million followers, which is almost the entire population of Los Angeles. He's ranked number 27th in follower count globally. And he's one of the top Latino Viners. So I asked him about his life as a professional Viner.
It's pretty cool.
We're just going to keep this brief. I think we're going to do about a 6-second interview. So you should be pretty good at this.
You probably could have done that.
Go. So I'm actually pulling up Vine right now.
All right, cool.
The last one you posted, which is really funny, about the feeling of losing your parents at the grocery store.
Oh, yeah.
Mom? Mom.
Mom! Mom!
Oh, you posted that an hour ago.
Just before I got here.
Did you, like, shoot it this morning or something?
No, I shoot Vines throughout the week and kind of just save them up, and then I post them as I wish, depending, you know, how I feel that day or what I feel like posting that day. But I have, like, a few more still in my phone.
So tell me about your life pre-Vine. Who were you?
I was just a normal guy, I guess you can say. I worked, you know, 9 to 5. I did finances. Did that for a long time. And then
what were you posting? What were the things that were gaining traction for you?
If you see my Vines, I have some consistent series. My character Juan is probably one of the biggest things.
And I wanna be legal. Immigration after me.
Senor, I can't come into work today.
Juan, I can see you at the neighbors.
Nicole! That's not me, that's my twin cousin Jose.
So he's one of the main reasons, that character. But I've also kept, like, my other series. I don't know if you've seen, like, If Men Had Periods. I do those.
If Men Had Periods.
You drink my chocolate milk?
Yeah.
That's fine.
Relatable comedy is really big. You gotta throw that out there.
Hey, can I squeeze in?
No. Dude, there's a table over there.
I wanna be
where the people are.
So something like that, from beginning to end, from the sort of the creation of the joke to shooting it and then uploading it, how long does that usually take?
I'd say a couple hours.
Wow. So would you say you spend a couple hours on most of your vines?
No. There's some vines that I spend 5 minutes on. Some of my biggest vines of, like, my career, I guess you could say, have been 10-minute concepts and 10-minute shot, one shot, done, posted, and then they just blew up.
And at what point did someone, I don't know who or what, approach you and say, we'll pay you for this?
Well, my first, I guess, someone that reached out to me to sponsor me was actually, I only had 7,000 followers at the time, and this clothing company wanted to sponsor me. They're like, hey, we want to sponsor you. We like your videos. We think you're hilarious. And that was my first one. And then once I got up to about 400, 500, that's when it was more like deals were coming in to do actual brand vines, not just clothing. And that was not even that long ago. It's probably like 10 months ago now.
And so once that happens, I mean, what do they say? Can you just do a vine that features our brand and we'll pay you a certain amount of money to do it?
Pretty much. They say, hey, we like your content. We think you're really funny and we want to make a video. Can you make a vine for us? And, you know, this is kind of what we're looking for. And then I make it for them. And if they like it, they like it. And we post and everything goes well. If not, then, you know, I have to go back and make another one for them and see how it goes. But that's pretty much, they just reach out to me.
Keep in mind, vines are only 6 seconds long. So brands like T-Mobile Latino, in David's case, will pay him money to feature their products and phones prominently in his short 6 second vines.
Hey, can you take a picture of
me? Yes.
Thanks, buddy.
What a nice guy.
Not every vine you post is sponsored.
No, only brand vines. I don't make money off of my regular vines, but those are actually the most important ones. They're more important because those are what your fans follow you for.
How many people on earth can say that they're making a living by doing this?
I would say at least the top, I don't even know, 50 Viners can make a living off of it. Maybe even 100 Viners make a living off of Vine.
One thing I've noticed on Vine is that it's an opportunity for a lot of people to bring up some interesting, like, racial issues.
Oh, hey, David, this is Tyrone.
Hey, what's up, Tyrone?
Why are you talking like that?
Tyrone!
Is he serious?
Hey, what's up, Cody?
Hey, man.
Are you kidding me?
I guess my Vines, I poke fun at stereotypes. Like, I make light of them to, like, make it not a serious issue, I guess. Growing up, like, I was not like, hey, let me tell you a joke. I was always a guy who would just say, like, a witty thing right then and there. My humor is always really quick.
Yeah, Vine is tailor-made for people like you.
But this is a long interview. I mean, it was like 30 vines, so it's good.
Do you just start measuring time in vines now?
Yeah, I'd be like, I'll be there in like 70 vines. Like, how far is Los Angeles? It's like 90 vines, so I'll be there. That's how we talk.
For Latino USA, I'm Michael Simon Johnson.
To see our favorite vines, check out our website, latinousa.org, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at LatinoUSA. Coming up on Latino USA, a look at the state of Latino studies.
The programs themselves are still not that visible and not that legitimate in a world and in a country in which Latinos are so important, right?
Stay with us.
Pasan y tú no estás,
tú no estás,
temo que el año me haga igual,
me haga igual.
Yo no sé qué voy a hacer, quiero verte a ti mujer,
a ti mujer.
Solo llamé para decirte que te espero, y aunque no me creas estoy siendo sincero.
Y si tuviera alas hacia ti yo vuelo para expresarte lo mucho.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Daisy Rosario in for Maria Hinojosa. Today we're talking about questions of genius, and in this case, study. Last month, the first ever International Latino-Latina Studies Conference was held in Chicago. Maria Hinojosa sat down with a group of leaders in the field to discuss the current state of Latino studies. But before we get into their conversation, we need to understand how Latino studies got started. It's a relatively young field. Latino studies came out of the ethnic studies movement in the late 60s and early 70s. Students of color protested because they felt that their history and experience wasn't reflected in university or college curricula.
That the demands of the black students and the third world liberation front are not discussable, negotiable, debatable, or compromisable.
Early departments focused mainly on Chicano or Puerto Rican studies, but as the Latino diaspora became more diverse, so did Latino studies departments. These departments have often come under attack by politicians. In 2013, Texas State Senator Dan Patrick presented a bill that would disqualify ethnic studies courses from counting toward core history requirements. And again, there were protests.
After September 1st, if we don't act, our heroes will not be in textbooks.
It never occurred to me that we would have to defend ethnic studies here in Texas.
The bill didn't pass, but bills like this one, book bans, and dissolved university departments reflect the challenges that Latino studies continues to face. Here's Maria Hinojosa.
I'm joined by Frances Aparicio, who's one of the organizers of the conference. She's the director of the Latino-Latina Studies Program at Northwestern University here in Chicago. Hey, Frances.
How are you?
Good, good. And Rusty Barceló is the president of Northern New Mexico College and nationally known for her work in diversity. Hola, Rusty.
Hello.
Juana Maria Rodriguez is a professor of gender and women's studies at UC Berkeley and the author of Queer Latinidad, Identity Practices, Discursive Spaces. Hey, Juana.
It's nice to be here.
Good. So let's start. It's a big, big question, but let's just try and define Latino-Latina studies as concisely as possible. Juana?
I mean, I think part of what we need to understand is that the formation of Latino studies really came about because these issues were not being addressed in the traditional disciplines. So we would study history without understanding the role of Latinos in that history. We would study literature without necessarily getting insight into Latino authors. And so I think that's the formation of these fields.
What's the problem? Why does the field of Latino-Latina studies confront challenges? And what are those challenges that you confront?
Well, one thing I might say is that, you know, education in general has become really politicized, right? So there is this idea that somehow education is supposed to be neutral, that we're supposed to be present both sides. So both sides to slavery, right? I mean, or both sides to immigration. So there's this outside perception that somehow we're being too political or we're only representing one side of this equation. Education is always invested in politics, whether you're studying Shakespeare or whether you're studying transnational migration.
Well, that's why it's kind of, I mean, isn't that about what academics do, is that you focus in on one area, you teach that area. Why this notion that you can't just teach Latino studies because somehow that means you're leaving someone out?
Well, I think there's another point that we need to consider is when it first came into being or when it was evolving, it was seen as political. It wasn't introduced in an educational kind of a context. And I think we've spent a long time trying to diffuse that kind of thinking when, in fact, it is very much an academic concept. It should be at the core mission of the institution. But Latino studies often has been seen as not as legitimate to the canon because it was started out in an interdisciplinary kind of a model. And so really, and also identifying it with identity politics, that it's only about Latinos when, in fact, you know, the Latino experience affects the entire United States, if not the world.
So I want you guys to, because all of you are from such different regions, Rusty, New Mexico, Juana, you're in Berkeley, Frances, you're in Evanston, outside of Chicago. Describe for me your student body. Just give me a typical example of some of your students.
Well, at Northern New Mexico College, our students represent 80% Latino at our institution, Hispano students, and 12% Native students. But even in an institution like that, where you would think this is a no-brainer, so to speak, these students are just engaged when all of a sudden they start to discover themselves.
What about your typical student body in Berkeley?
Well, you know, before I came to Berkeley, I was at Bryn Mawr College, and I think that's a really interesting point of comparison. I mean,
Bryn Mawr College
is outside of Philadelphia, small, elite, liberal
very
arts.
Elite.
And teaching Latino literature and culture there, you know, I would have the student from South Texas that had been a farm worker. I would have the Dominican student from Harlem. I would have the daughter that, you know, from Mexico City that went to high school with her bodyguard, right? And so it was actually a great manufactured diversity, but it was actually a great context for teaching about Latino issues.
Were your students like Rusty students, who many of them say this was life-changing for them to learn, to be in a Latino studies class?
Yes.
Same thing for you?
Yes, I think it was. And what I thought was interesting about that context was precisely engaging with those differences, because the student from Mexico City is sitting next to the girl that was picking oranges, right, from Texas. And so who's also Mexicana, right? But somehow there's this kind of gap, right? In California, because it's a large state public school, I think there's actually less diversity in some ways. So getting students in California to think about Black Latinos, for example, really? You know, or it's just not something that's part of their landscape.
Because you've had to confront this as professors, have you come up with ways in which you're able to do something really effective to make that one kid who is resistant, let's say, why do I have to be in this Latino studies class, to then say, oh, no, there's this other way of looking at it?
I use a lot of popular culture in my classes because I think one of the ways in which not just Latino students, but, you know, all kinds of students are dancing to Daddy Yankee. The other thing that I talk about a lot is law. I mean, it's curious. I teach a class, Race, Gender, and Justice, and talking about, like, stop and frisk, right? And for me, making that connection to that white student is saying, okay, where are the cops on a Saturday night? Are they in front of frat row, right, at Berkeley? Are they there looking for underage drinking and drug use? Or are they, you know, in the streets of, you know, Oakland?
So do you use the fact that you are trying to get your Latino students to identify with their identity and personal history as a way to draw out non-Latino students and say, we want to hear your history too? It's equal valid, Francis?
Well, it is, and I think it's important also to recognize within those, throughout those personal histories, you know, the power differentials. I mean, you know, which immigrant groups, you know, get more access to resources when they come in? How do they get defined, you know, when they come in? I mean, some are more white, some are less white. The colonial history between Latin America and the United States that already, you know, frames immigrants from Latin America as cheap labor. One important thing about our courses is also that mixed race students are beginning now to be part of our student population. And when you have a Colombian, you know, the child of a Colombian father and a white mother, or, you know, even now the intralatinos too, like the Mexican child, you know, students.
My kids are Dominimex.
Yeah. But then, you know, all of these mixed identities now are also part of our discussion, and they have to be included too.
Now, I am a professor 6 months out of the year at DePaul University here in Chicago, and I am part of the Latin American, Latino, Latina Studies Department. Mm-hmm. But my students will often say, mi mamá no sabe por qué estudio esto. Mm-hmm. My mom and dad just say, why are you studying Latino studies? Mm-hmm. How are you going to get a job? So what do you say?
When you graduate with a BA in psychology, you don't go out and be a psychologist, right? What education is about learning to read, learning to write persuasively. The other thing is, if you're going into media, you know, Latinos are a market, right? Mm-hmm. If you're going into advertising, if you're going into the tech industry, if you're going into healthcare, these are communities that are underserved.
One of the things I think we do have to do, and it's one of the things I ask my faculty, because we also have to convince our faculty as to why studying Latino studies is an important field, what do we want our students to know? Do we want them to be prepared to go into the world? Mm-hmm. And this should be but one part of that discussion, and it is not right now. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to me that in spite of the changing demographics, not to see Latino studies as an important part of educating all of our students, I think we're failing our students in the end.
Because you want everyone to be taking Latino studies classes.
Including our faculty.
This is the first time that you have a gathering of this size to talk about Latino-Latina studies. What's the dream of what happens after this inaugural conference of Latino-Latina studies here in Chicago?
We don't want to standardize the field because I think it is so diverse and so richly heterogeneous, right? But also advocate for the needs and the interests of the scholars across the country. The programs themselves are still not that visible and not that legitimate in a world and in a country in which Latinos are so important, right? So I think that in itself is part of the goal.
President Rusty Barceló.
One of the things that we forget is that Latino studies in many ways has already transformed higher education, and there's very little acknowledgement of the contributions that we've made to higher education. We've introduced what to teach, how to teach, and we do it differently. And so we've created, I think, a whole discourse that I think has affected interdisciplinarity just in general on college campuses. For example, part of our original missions, if you will, through Chicano studies, Puerto Rican studies, Latino studies, is our engagement with the community. It is now common practice. That came out of our efforts. But there's very little recognition of what Latino studies has done for higher education in general.
Francis?
The idea is that once the association picks up and gets organized and structured, then we will be able to have a space and we will continue to have these spaces for discussion every 2 years.
Well, thanks so much for this great conversation. I think we'll pick it up probably in 2 years, if not before.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria.
That was Francis Aparicio, professor and director of the Latino-Latina Studies Program at Northwestern University. Nancy, also known as Rusty Barceló, the president of Northern New Mexico College, and Juana Maria Rodriguez, professor of Women and Gender Studies at Berkeley University, sitting down with Maria Hinojosa. We thank them for taking the time during the conference to speak with us. They say imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, and that the line between genius and insanity is razor thin. Puerto Rican singer-songwriter Rosa Diaz's first full-length album, Whim, features elements of campfire love ballads, shoegaze pop, and folkloric Latin genres. Rosa Diaz herself describes it as her happy album. But her newest upcoming work was inspired by one of the most controversial figures in literature. Latino USA's Nadia Raymond went to find out what happens when you start searching for sabiduría, you might even say genius, on a dark note.
I met singer-songwriter Rosa Diaz at this year's Latin Alternative Music Conference in a large room filled with other artists. She's a petite, almost bird-like lady who wears cat-eye 50s glasses and a flower in her hair. She doesn't seem like the type of person who lived life on the edge. But then I asked her what was her latest inspiration.
My main project that I've been working on is called For Boys Who Like Bukowski, a healing album for broken men.
An album inspired by Charles Bukowski, a writer who's known as the opposite of gentle.
He just walked up and asked them to go to bed with him. I think that's very honest, I said.
Rosa Diaz is all about the messy art that was Bukowski and the mess that she thinks Bukowski made of some men. Her new project is more
about the stereotype or the ideal that men have of Bukowski. He was a late bloomer and he was working at a post office. Suddenly he's famous and his books are translated in all these languages and he's got sugar babies. And you know, that's kind of something that I guess men still want. It's a greater work about how to encourage men to heal and to not always pretend that that's what they want.
And it's a project that, for Rosa, became something bigger than just a record.
It's centered around the Bukowski stereotype. Broken men, lots of storytelling in the songwriting, a lot of cuss words that have to, like, visit some red light districts. No, just kidding.
But she wasn't kidding. Rosa really wanted to know what it was like to be Bukowski in order to write like Bukowski. So she went all method. For an entire summer, Rosa woke up every morning and put vodka in her coffee. She stayed out late. She went to strip clubs and music nights and bars. She did some things she won't talk about for the radio.
Woke up this morning, it seemed to me that every nap and drop to be a little bit more like Bukowski.
She recorded podcasts like this.
No, I don't know what kind of man you're talking about, but they're not anywhere in my...
Who's going to wash our bloomers? Wait, I don't wear bloomers. Speak for yourself.
Well, you said...
I wear boy shirts.
I wear tongs.
Knickers. Oh, whoa, you're a tongs girl.
And she started to make music that eventually became this. But then, in the middle of it all, something happened.
I started getting TMJ, where your muscles in your jaw start to go out of control. And I talked to some people about it, and, you know, one of the guys from one of the music nights that I was going to, he said, it's the wine. I ended up having to go to the doctor because it wouldn't go away, and it was really scary. And the doctor said it was no alcohol. Was spelled out very, very harshly. I had to take some time off from everything.
Rosa had to stop. Bukowski was hurting her. In addition to the problems from alcohol, Rosa was also not eating well, so she had to learn to be fully healthy again from scratch. It took her 3 months to get better.
Because of the excessive drinking, I lost a little bit of my centeredness, and I was obsessing a little bit too much about my own loneliness and kind of wallowing. But I started jamming with old Latin jazz guys, and improvisation was a big thing that I took out of it.
She's been documenting everything she's done on multiple blogs. She wrote one under a male pen name, but accidentally deleted it when she was drinking too much. But regardless, her first inklings of inspiration still resonate. And in some ways, she says her life and Bukowski's are connected.
A lot of his voice was something that I've been expressing myself in my writing without really knowing it. And it was really weird because, you know, I'm a Puerto Rican female from North Philadelphia. But I've had some really rough experiences. I had a really horrible accident, you know, when I was a little bit younger, and I broke my back and my pelvis, and so my writing kind of got really dark. When I started reading him, I kind of understood, yeah, this is real. He's not just writing this to say these things.
Beware of men who don't remember the dream.
For Latino USA, I'm Nadia Raymond.
That's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Katie Davis, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejiro. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Sarah Barrett, Roxanne Scott, and Julia Alsop. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks to Lourdes Torres, who helped organize our conversation about Latino studies. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your guest host and producer, Daisy Rosario, in for executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And Latino USA's tech coverage is supported by the KPOR Center for Social Impact, which leverages technology for positive, progressive change. Tech for good, good for tech. KPORcenter.org.
Look, I put jokes in my science reports, okay?
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring with a floor finder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.